You're listening to Vatican Radio.
Moral leadership and the work of faith-based organisations in bringing warring parties to the negotiating table are more and more of value in a world in which conflict continues to sow misery and injustice. More specifically, the moral leadership of Pope Francis and the engagement of organisations like the St. Egidio Community, which is currently overseeing peace agreements between the governments and warring factions in Central African Republic and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, act as catalysts and provide momentum to much-needed peacemaking diplomacy. This is the opinion of Ambassador Alexander Lascaris, the deputy and the commander for civil military engagement of the United States Africa Command, a man with a lifetime experience working in Africa, who was recently in Rome to tie up with the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See and with St. Egidio. Ambassador Lascaris spoke to me about how his personal experience in Africa impacts his work today and about how he views the action of the Catholic Church in fostering dialogue and reconciliation.
As Africa Command, you know, we serve a broader diplomatic engagement strategy of the United States government. And as the United States government, certainly in Africa, we are in constant need to be in partnership with the moral leadership of African partner nations. And in a whole number of countries undergoing tragic crises, one of the main sources of moral leadership is the Catholic Church and the Holy See, the Vatican Foreign Ministry, the religious orders who operate in all of these countries. Right now, tragically, they're some of the last witness we have in some of these crisis areas, but they're also probably the best convening authority to bring competing factions to the table, but at the same time to break the monopoly of armed men on peace processes and to say that, to make peace, you obviously have to talk to the people with the guns, but to make durable peace, they cannot have a monopoly. And so I think particularly in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Central African Republic, I think the church is our best bet for convening the parties and locking them into a framework for peace that the rest of us, U.S. government through its broad support and Africa Command through the military side, to give us a structure. Peace can only succeed if there is a viable framework that gets the parties, both the armed parties and I think more importantly the unarmed parties, around a table locked into a framework. And where we have frameworks, I think we have a better chance of success. Where we don't have frameworks is where we're going to struggle.
Are you going to be in contact with the St. Egidio
Absolutely.
Community?
Yeah, I'll be at St. Egidio primarily to talk about the Central African Republic. You know, St. Egidio is a wonderful, accidental, miraculous institution that got into peace building in Mozambique in the 80s, sort of by accident. I think they had a Mozambican seminary, and they are, I think, the leading track to Catholic organization. And I've worked with them in Burundi extensively, obviously very familiar with their work in Mozambique. And again, we're searching for a framework to lock parties into peace agreements. And so they've had, I think, 14 of the 15 armed groups in the Central African Republic signing a ceasefire. Now, it's not holding. And that's tragic and it's concerning. But the fact that we have a document that represents commitments of factions means that the diplomacy, including the military diplomacy, can support a framework. So, yeah, I'm very excited to go talk to the session.
Are you actually involved in the peace talks in any way?
No. Obviously, our embassy in Bangui integrated into the broader United Nations effort, both through the peacekeeping operation and through the diplomatic engagement. So as Africa Command, one of our main roles, frankly, is to train and equip the peacekeeping contingents who are operating within the Central African Republic. For example, the Zambians are operating on the border with Chad, but as we are not a direct participant in the peace process.
Pope Francis has spoken repeatedly of the Central African Republic. He's been there himself. How important is his voice in the international scenario on raising awareness and acting as a magnet?
Well, specifically to the Central African Republic, the Pope walked from the Catholic Cathedral of Bangui to the mosque in the PK5 in the Muslim neighborhood, which was crossing a literal battle line, but it was also crossing a metaphorical battle line. And it was an act of personal courage. It was physical courage, But I think more importantly, it was an act of moral courage. And you know, we were talking in the elevator about South Africa, having been fortunate to have lived there during the transition. And the lesson I take from that is the power of moral leadership. And in crises, leaders emerge, good and bad. And the presence, the availability of positive moral leadership, I think, is an underappreciated historical factor in the destiny of nations. So I think his visit to the Central African Republic catalyzed a successful elections process. And it took what was going to be a very difficult, dangerous, and bloody transition and made it happen. I don't use the word miraculously lightly. It made something that many people with experience in the Central African Republic expected to be violent and made it go off peacefully. Now, there's been a resurgence of violence in the Central African Republic, but if you read about it, the first thing you hear is the local bishop, the local cardinal flew to Bangassou or Bria or Obo. And this is one of the last remaining moral authorities that can calm the situation. And the Pope represents that moral authority in large parts of Africa, large parts of the world, obviously, focused on Africa. But to broaden it beyond the Pope, beyond the Catholic Church, you know, communities of faith, clerics, whether they are Muslim, whether they are Christian, you've got to empower the moral leadership to come to the fore.
Your CV is very striking. You were in South Africa during its transition to democracy, but you were also in Kosovo, you were in Liberia, you were in Burundi, all countries that have seen important transitions. So you bring a lot of personal experience and wisdom. What is your message to countries in conflict and to people who are trying to negotiate?
Well, the first message is who sits at the table. And by necessity, if you have an armed conflict, the armed groups are the people you have to talk to. But you have to broaden that out. You need civil society actors, you need faith-based communities, you need women particularly. And this is not only a statement of ideology. There is a pretty compelling data set that tells us that the durability of a peace process is directly proportional to the inclusivity of the actors, which is a shorthand way of saying, if you've only got the armed actors around the table, it's a resource deal between criminal elites. And I think that the tragedy of South Sudan has been that the only people empowered to make peace are the people empowered to make war. And that also serves as a perverse incentive. If you want the spoils of peace, you're obliged to make war.
So, why are women so important?
Again, I think there is a compelling data set that says when women are involved in peace processes, they have a longer shelf life. Also, as you address humanitarian needs, you very quickly understand that the way to reach vulnerable communities, vulnerable populations, is through individual women and, more importantly, through the collective work of women. And if you go even deeper into sort of African views of the universe and of the world, particularly in West Africa, where I've just come from 3.5 years in Guinea, in the Malinke cosmology, the source of all conflict is the inevitable competition of brothers of the same father. But the equal and opposite countervailing principle of the universe, which is called Madenya, is the inevitable reconciliation of sons of the same mother. And so there is something, you know, postmodern, Western, American, ideological, we need women at the table for this menu of women's rights, which all of us obviously subscribe to. But to give that traction, certainly in West Africa, you have to link it into the culture, which says that the source of all reconciliation, of all peace, is motherhood. And frankly, there's a very practical side.
It's very
of this.
Beautiful.
Well, on the practical
thank
side.
Thank you for sharing that.
If you're distributing humanitarian relief supplies, the best chance you have of getting it to the people who need it is giving it to mothers.
Absolutely.
Giving it to women. Women steal less than unfortunately or fortunately.
And they want to feed their children.
Absolutely.
And they want a future for their children.
So really, the reason I'm coming here is to acknowledge the importance of the moral leadership of religious communities, and in this case, obviously, the Catholic Church and its presence, its organs throughout these countries, and to send the message that, you know, we are looking for your leadership and we are looking to fall in behind that leadership. Now, obviously, as a military organization, we're not going to align ourselves, and the Church probably would not want us aligned, but, you know, there's a UN effort, African Union efforts, and there's a military dimension to the broader diplomacy. And one thing about, you know, if you working with the U.S. military as long as I have and through 3 years in Iraq in particular, nobody in the leadership of the U.S. military has any illusions that these crises can be solved through the application of force. Now, obviously, we're not pacifists, and in many of these, there is a military dimension, whether it's peacekeeping or, in some cases, offensive military operations. But we understand that these are governance crises, that these are crises of institutional legitimacy in many of the affected countries. And so if the problem is governance, so is the solution.
You were part of a new government in the United States. I think Obama appointed you as
ambassador to Guinea.
Yes. What about Mr. Trump? Have you had any indications of any particular interest he may have in African affairs?
You know, I think people are following that the sort of the State Department down at the regional level has been slow to get the new leadership. So the short answer is, you know, we're still in a holding pattern waiting for the senior leadership of the Africa Bureau of the State Department, of the National Security Council, and AID, USAID, who will come in. And the reason you have a political transition is so the newly elected government can fulfill its mandate and can put its people in the positions to drive the policy one way or the other way. And we are public servants, and so obviously we respond to that. But I would tell you that historically there are more constants in U.S.-Africa policy than changes. Because a lot of, you know, who is our constituency for Africa? Well, a sizable portion of the U.S. population has its origins in Africa, either through the first diaspora of the slave trade or a modern post-war diaspora of modern immigration around the time of my father, by the way. So that's always been a constituency.
Where did your father come from?
He came from Greece after World War II. And so I always remember that I'm the son of poor immigrants. And so there they obviously have the immigrants' attachment to their homeland. So we have Cuban-American diasporas, Armenian-American diasporas, Greek-American diasporas. So we have an African diaspora in the United States writ large, and then in the modern time, Ethiopian diaspora, et cetera. So we respond to that. But America's first great exposure to Africa came through missionaries. And so churches, particularly, in the case of the United States, Protestant denominations led the way into Africa and were the earliest civil society organizations as we know it. Were champions of human rights, of anti-slavery, and getting into the mid to late 20th century, became champions of liberation, of freedom. And so my introduction to Africa was via the Catholic Institute of Education of South Africa. And the Catholic Church in South Africa in apartheid, when I showed up, had emerged as a voice for liberation.
Absolutely.
You know, and I was involved in giving academic education to Africans. And you know that was against one of the pillars of apartheid, which said that, you know, Africans should only be educated to a certain level with an eye towards vocational skills. And so the very act of providing an academic-based education through 12th grade with an anticipation of tertiary education, obviously as Americans we think of that as routine, boring, so what? And one of the things I had to learn about going to South Africa in 1989 was I was involved in a revolutionary, and many South Africans viewed it as subversive activity of providing academic education. So I've always approached Africa with that memory that religion is keyed towards social justice, progress, and legitimate demands for greater freedoms.
And what about your experience as a teacher in South Africa in those years? That must have been incredibly enriching also in the light of what you do today.
You know, it was wonderful. It's the vivid memory I carry with me at all times. And it also, you know, it grounds me in trying to have some memory, as perhaps fading, of what the real Africa is. So in those days, I would hitchhike, I would take the combis, I would eat pop and flies. I think I was making $200 a month in those days, 500 rand a month. So I experienced Africa as a normal person, if you will. You know, today as an ambassador, I go back, I met at the airport with a limousine and a motorcade, and I'm ushered into the presidential palace and the five-star hotel. I would not want to do what I do now without having had that experience. And as I get older and as those memories fade, I cling to it more and more. As I look at the crises of Africa right now, I remember where I started, and I remember where my father started as a war-displaced refugee in 1946. And so as you look at the migrant issue of sub-Saharan Africans taking this perilous journey across the Sahel, the Sahara, onto the Mediterranean, okay, my European colleagues, it is a political issue. It is a very vexing political issue, but I try to remember and remind people that this is a human issue. These are people who don't have choices in life and who, if they want the goods for themselves and their families, they are obliged to submit themselves to this horrific passage where they are abused and assaulted, in the case of women, raped. And they're doing it not because they want to, but because they feel that they need to. So that it's important to me that I always be able to maintain the connection of being a poor school teacher at a South African township in 1989.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Lascaris. Is there anything you'd like to add?
You know, I think one of the key roles of the church in Africa right now is witness. It's getting increasingly dangerous for expatriates, for foreigners in large parts of the continent. It's getting increasingly expensive to deploy people to where the suffering is and to where the violence is. And so as you look at the Congolese-Angolan border, so you look at the central part of the Central African Republic, the church and its people, the lay people, the clerics, some of the last eyes and ears we have out there who can remind the world of what's going on. So it's very valuable to me that that we maintain that link, that witness leads to pressure on people like me to take action.
That was Ambassador Alexander Lascaris, the Deputy to the Commander for Civil Military Engagement of the United States Africa Command.